Well, welcome back. This week to Solid Ground, this class, in my opinion, is going to be one of the more interesting ones over the summer, because we've been doing some maybe relatively technical things, both from a scientific and a philosophical and logical perspective over the course of the summer. This one, and maybe the next one, because I imagine this will kind of spill into the next time, or it ought to, I think. This one is a real wrap-up that lets us take the 50,000-foot view of everything that we've been doing. So we've been very much in the weeds, and not everybody likes being in the weeds too terribly much. But we're going to add to all the arguments that we've had. We're going to let Al do a quick guest, ten minutes, however long he wants to take, to talk about an argument that's not maybe in the canon of normal arguments in there, but has arisen from the Christian philosophical side, especially in the Reformed tradition. And Al will annotate what he means by, or what I mean by that. And then we'll get on to some other interesting things. We had just done a quick, I say quick, you can see how many slides there are on the right side. It was an 11-question survey, two of which were trying to figure out whether someone's just pencil-whipping the survey. So really a 9-question survey that talk about some of the basic truths that we've been talking about. And this is 700 and something respondents, so it was not a bad sample size so far. We'll talk about that, and then we'll talk about a little bit more of the basic truths that we've talked about. But without any further ado, Al, do you want to fire away? And you can talk from there, talk from here, whatever you want to do.
Okay, it's my turn. Should I go up there?
Why not? We're on a cost per person basis. This is a very expensive piece of gear right here, so we'll cut that in half right now.
All right. Let's see. The transcendental argument for God, also known as TAG for short, T-A-G. Cornelius Van Til's the one that came up with it, and Greg Bahnsen, I think, did the best job of explaining it and using it in his debates. So if you ever get a chance to listen to Greg Bahnsen, there are at least 3 debates that are recorded on audio, so you can hear how he uses that argument. And I'm going to start by defining what a transcendental argument is. Everyone's familiar with inductive reasoning and deductive reasoning. A transcendental reasoning takes any statement, any proposition, and asks what must already be true in order for this statement to be true. It's basically, with Greg Bahnsen, he would start with something that the unbeliever agrees with, that believes that this is true, I'm sure of this. And then it would go take it from there. And let's see. Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, they have the, under transcendental arguments, the form of it is X is a necessary condition for the possibility of Y, where then, given that Y is the case, it logically follows that X must be the case as well. And let's see, Cornelius Van Til, he said, a truly transcendental argument takes any fact of experience which it wishes to investigate and tries to determine what the presuppositions of such a fact must be in order to make it what it is. And Van Til, he had a couple problems with most apologist arguments. One problem was that a lot of times the apologists would unwittingly appeal to science and reason as if they were independent authorities, independent of God, in order to show that God exists. And of course, if you appeal to an authority independent of God, you've got a problem there trying to, So that was a problem. And the other one was that a lot of apologists would argue that God is most probably exists. And, it's like, most of the evidence points to God, and some of it points away from God. It's what kind of a strange reality are we living in where some of it's pointing toward God? So obviously, if God created the whole universe, all the objective evidence, all the physical evidence points to God. The problem isn't with the evidence, the problem's with us, that we're looking at it the wrong way. And we have, you know, some of the evidence pointing this way, some is pointing that way. But it's not really. It's all pointing the right direction. We're just looking at it the wrong way. And so the transcendental argument for God, it asks, how is human rationality possible? What starting point logically leads to the idea of human rationality, which is when Greg Bahnsen would go and debate, he would focus his attention on how are we even having this debate? How is this even possible that there's, you know, he'd be up there and then the atheist would be up there on stage. They both have to agree. In order to have a debate, you have to agree there's a right and wrong way of thinking, which presupposes that there's a common standard, which presupposes that there's a common authority, which, so Greg Bahnsen would say, you know, you're already contradicting your own argument when you're arguing against God, because God is the basis for their being. Basically, when you look at what are the basic axioms that are necessary for having a debate or having rationality for reason and all that, faith in God is the ultimate axiom. Without trusting that God created our minds and senses and orderly world, we cannot prove anything. And so that's the argument in one sentence, is that without God, the only proof of God is that without God, you cannot prove anything. So that's the
transcendental. All right, thank you. This argument, obviously, is an interesting one because it's really the only one that I know of that's in the main areas of discussion, at least, or at least it has been discussed to some degree, that's really epistemic in nature. That is to say, it's the only one that asks the question of how is it that you know anything, and why, and based on how you know stuff, what should that imply about what it is that you are thinking? When I say which it is, what it is you're thinking about those most basic levels. So it's a very interesting argument, and so I recommend it to your further study as well. We can also spend some time on it discussing, as we may discuss some of these other ones too. Okay. I had said previously, one of the things that I have continued to claim is that if you go out, you know, with the microphone and do the Man in the Street interview, and you do what I wish everybody would do, which is don't talk to anybody who's willing to talk to you. Instead, go find somebody that's unwilling to talk to you and convince them or cajole them or buy them into talking to you. Because it seems like the people that you get to talk to the microphone most of the time are the last people we would want to represent our own viewpoints if they happen to hold our own viewpoints. But if you got an honest opinion out of a normal, reasonable person, and you said, what do you think about some proposition where that's one of the things that are the basic propositions that we have talked about in these arguments? I've been saying that all things being equal, almost everybody agrees with all of the premises of all of these arguments for God, unless they recognize that it's a part of an argument, in which case, now that we dig our heels in and we say, well, maybe that's not the case, and have you thought of this, etc. So in order to try to show that's the case, I put that survey out. I put it online yesterday. These Mechanical Turk folks, whoever they are, if you're out there, does anybody in here ever do any work for Mechanical Turk? I don't know what I don't know how you make money at doing this, but for 10 cents they could take this survey. So I actually put a lot of the premises that we have been talking about up there and got, I'll say, some interesting results. Many of them could be predicted. One of them I had not predicted would be the case. And then after thinking about it, I think I have an explanation of why it turned out to the way that it did. But we can talk about it and kick it around. So here was the first question on the survey. Anything that exists has some sort of cause or explanation for its existing. Now, the first line up there says certainly true. The second, and all of these are basically the same. The top line is certainly true. Second one is probably true. Middle one is I don't know. This one's probably false. This one is definitely false. Now, I do have to pull, I had a couple of control questions in there. And so something like a few couple percent of these have been pencil whipped. So often the ones where people... this one's not quite as easy to see, but there are some other questions where you're like, there's nobody, anyone would really have answered that way. Well, I still have yet to deconflict with the pencil whippers and whether those answers came from the pencil whippers or not, but I'm headed in that direction.
I can't quite see the x-axis. Is that percentages or...
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. That's total count of answers. So on this scale, it's zero. The last number there is 350. And each one of these are all unique respondents, and that at least the uniqueness of the respondents' identification has been verified. Whether there are anybody out there who's taken this survey under five different identities, Amazon tries to control for that, but I don't know how effective they are at doing that. And so I try to control for that by having a larger survey group than possible, which would feed right into Amazon's model and motivate them to not want to fix the problem because they make more money that way. Okay. On this one, that anything that exists has some sort of cause or explanation for its existing, you'll see that the vast, vast majority of people think that that's the case. Let me show you another interesting question. Things can pop into existence without any cause or explanation. That's the same question. That's the same question, and look at the difference. Now, I went to my wife, who's a PhD statistician and psychologist, to explain some of this, and she basically shook her head and said, "You have a poorly designed test in this case," because I'm thinking we in this class are thinking things in the way that philosophers talk about things. She was thinking, "Hey, an average respondent on the survey may think that's like a thought that pops into my head." Yeah. So everybody in here is like, "Yeah, probably false." So. That's another good reason to ask questions a couple of ways, so I can do another version of this, and will in the future, where we kind of figure out what the difference is between the two, and that it's probably, this is the question that we wanted to ask, and the other one included things like thoughts popping into my head. Nobody in there was thinking, and that's a quantum event, and quantum events are fundamentally acausal, and therefore, bad question on my part.
Anything that exists, that's a good
one. Yeah. That's right.
And
hopefully that's where they went. And I'm trying to figure out, these are hard for me to word, and so before we do this one again, I'll probably seek whoever's interested in input in sculpting this so that it's a better survey at some point. Okay, here's this one. I think that if you asked this question 100 years ago, 150 years ago, you would have gotten a very different set of answers. But right now, certainly true. 500 of the, you can see this is everybody at the top says certainly or probably true, don't know, and definitely false. So people in general will say things like, yes, the universe began to exist at some point in the past. I think that this is due to modern physics. It was not the case prior to 1900 that the majority of people were certain that that was the case. I think a lot of people thought the universe could have been infinite in the past, and at least a lot of the scientific community thought that was the case, but it's been the advent of basically Big Bang theory and the similar types and all the stuff that came out of Hubble's assumptions and these things that I think have made the majority of people in our culture believe that this is the case. So whereas theists may have a reason to see it this way, everybody in the culture sees it this way today. Yes, sir.
I didn't take this quiz. I didn't see it.
No, it wasn't for anybody in this class. This was out in some random population of people that are on Amazon that sit around and do these things and others. Okay.
Well, I can, as the only atheist in here, I can say I would agree with number one, but not with number two.
So you think the universe might begin to exist at some point? Might have been eternal in the past.
My problem is the word past.
Yeah.
Because that implies time.
Yep.
So that's, I'd be somewhere down at the bottom of.
Or what about if it was changed, the universe began to exist?
If this question said what?
If the universe, just the universe began to exist.
If the universe began to exist.
Didn't say anything about the past, just said began to exist.
Period.
Well, I'd be more inclined to agree with it, but
okay.
I wouldn't be part of the first line.
Gotcha. This one, so on the probably false and definitely false, I'm assuming that that comes out when we, you know, whoever, I will certainly try to find out the user IDs if people think that it's definitely false that torturing children to death for fun is okay. I assume that that was pencil whippers, although the number of respondents that said definitely false and probably false exceeds my error bar right now on people who I know have done it, have pencil whipped it the wrong way for certain. So there's some statistical.
Almost exactly equal.
Yeah. I'm unclear as to why that is, unless don't know probably false and definitely false, each of them being 20% distributed and random, that those three are the truest. This may have been the best control question. I hope this was the best control question. If this wasn't the best control question, our society is in serious trouble. Or we figured out a very interesting way to identify psychopaths before they do anything particularly bad. I'm joking.
If you left out for fun, mm-hmm. that might look a little different.
Right. The reason I put for fun in there is that so nobody says, well, there could have been a good reason for having to do it.
What the respondents, do you know the nationalities of the respondents? Or?
I know the nationalities of the people that wanted to make sure they got paid. Mm-hmm. And they're principally, it happens in our time zone. So I think we've got a mix of Southwest, Southeast Asian, and North American respondents, all English language. Or at least this was all done in English language. Whether they took it in the English language or not remains to be seen.
That might explain some of the answers.
Yeah, it might explain some of the answers. But you'll see the control questions here. So this one, though, obviously most people think it's certainly true that something like that's wrong. This is why, by the way, when people ask what I think the best argument is, it depends on what you mean by best. So the moral argument depends on this as a premise. And the premise is objective morals values exist. So if you agreed, if you said certainly true, or even if you said probably true, you're agreeing that at least probably objective moral values exist.
No.
The reason I like the moral argument is more than any other premise that you're going to see in here, there's agreement on this one. And what that means is from at least an intuitive baseline perspective, the human being believes that objective morals exist. They typically, remember we talked about properly basic beliefs, their properly basic belief is morals are objective. They find defeaters for that sometimes and say, well, my defeater for believing that is, well, that can't be the case if we arose evolutionarily and there is no God. I believe that we arose evolutionarily and there is no God, so that's not the case, so here's my defeater. And then maybe they eventually find a defeater for that defeater and they're back to their properly basic belief. But ultimately, the reason, the moral argument's not my favorite for a bunch of other reasons, but it is the one that should be most intuitive to people when they first see it. Okay, this one is the one that surprised me. And Tracy explains to me that she believes that the majority of people misunderstood this question. I basically ask, is the universe deterministic? The universe had to be exactly the way it is and could not have been different than it is now. I thought that was confusing enough, so I put an example in there. You had to have what you did for breakfast this morning. It is impossible you could have eaten something different. And a majority of people said that's probably or definitely false. So that's a majority of people saying this universe is so deterministic that they didn't have any choice about what they had for breakfast. So I don't get to throw out questions and say, well, I don't think that they understood it. That's not how science works. I can refine them and ask it in a better way next time. But ultimately, let's say that this is the case. Why might this be the case? My assumption would be these are the inroads made possibly by people making statements about free will and modern neuroscience, saying, you know, neuroscience shows there's no such thing as free will, or other statements that in reality are not empirically justified, but that's what hits the popular press very frequently.
You're saying there's negative numbers.
Well, I'm saying the certainly true, probably true, I'm sorry, I did say majority, the certainly true, probably true numbers are much bigger than I thought they would have been, in that they represent something like almost a third, I think, of the respondents. So why did a third of people-ish, a quarter to a third of people say that is the case? I don't know. Okay, so that one is a little bit of an anomaly from what I expected. Here was a control question. Please select the first answer. So anybody not doing that.
Zacharias said something to the effect of like, you know, most of your
what was that
disbelief.
Please select the first answer.
Most of the disbelief that you have is based on some premise, and most oftentimes those premises are untested.
Right.
It would be kind of an opening to that kind of thing where, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, no, like, I had to have had cereal for breakfast. I'm like, you could be in this class, ask three questions, and be like, all right, that was a ridiculous statement, sorry.
Yeah, right. That's an interesting way of putting it, yeah. Yeah, good point. Dennis, this is just a control question. Please select the first answer to the question. So it's supposed to screen out anybody that answers differently than that. I can take their ID number and pull out the rest of their responses because they're probably just pencil whipping the exercise. Okay, this was the things can pop into existence without any cause or explanation. Maybe that was intended to be thoughts as well. Again, something like 40% of people said, yeah, that can happen. But earlier they said that can't happen. So this was intended towards the ontological argument. It's possible that God exists. So the vast majority think that's probably true. Some people say they don't know. So that represents the epistemic group of like, I'm not really sure if it's even possible. That's probably a really good answer, because if you understand it the way that we're asking it, which is not do you think it's the case, but is it even logically possible for that to be the case?
Well, the atheist in a room would be in the top row.
Yes.
That it's possible.
Okay. And
not
that's,
necessarily. Because yeah, is a definitely no. You know, if you can't prove it by science or whatever, it can't possibly. I mean, it's like, he says God is as likely as leprechauns.
Yeah,
I don't have an experience with leprechauns, but
I think and Dennis is a more thoughtful atheist or agnostic or however you want to characterize him or however he likes to characterize himself. He doesn't like to go by agnostic. But Dennis at least admits the possibility. So we'll call him a soft atheist. I've heard that term bandied about. If a soft atheist, well, in that his atheism is soft, not he is soft. But I think the reason Dennis's approach is the more reasonable approach is that if you're going to say it's not logically possible that God exists, then you have to have an airtight argument against the possibility of God's existence. Now, if you said cousin or
brother,
if your brother did have such an argument, then he could be justified in doing so. But this breaks out or starts to call out something else I'd like to extract from this, which is when you see the last question, you'll see where some of this other stuff comes from. It may be the case, or I would like to say that it is the case, that our belief in the truth of the premises, especially if they sound religious or irreligious or anything like that, has more to do with what we already believe or want to believe than it has to do with our actual assessment of whether they're true or not. So when you see the last question, you'll see why I'm saying that.
The questions that you asked, were these basically an even mix of male and female, or were there more of male or female?
Unfortunately, I don't have that tracked. I can say from brushing my eyes over the data that there's a mix, but it seems to be more men than women, maybe 2-to-1-ish. But generally speaking, there are ladies are not a vanishingly small proportion of who's doing this work, but it seems like the majority may be guys. But I have not tracked that. In fact, I'm not even sure I can say that with any certainty.
I think women are too busy to be on their computer doing stupid stuff.
Maybe the case. So I tried to do the math on how do you take a five, you know, it was a 2 minutes worth of survey here. And I guess if you're doing a survey and getting 10 cents every 2 minutes, that's 30 times 10, that's what you're making in an hour. So if you're up for $3 an hour, Mechanical Turk's a good place to be.
Oh, you paid people to answer these questions?
Yes, yeah.
Well, shit,
We'll, I'll pay even more than 10 cents. So.
12 cents.
You should be arguing for at least 15. Okay, this one's another moral question. You can see the probably false and definitely false. These are probably within the range of the people who are pencil whipping it as well. So ultimately, I think is a very strong intuition that objective morals really do exist. And the only time people disagree that objective morals exist is when they're aware that it's a, not the only time, the vast majority of people would disagree is if they found out that that's a premise in an argument that comes to a conclusion that they're not up for.
Chesterton said something very interesting about this, though. He said that everything is, there's a certain lawlessness that runs underneath the course of where we care only for what's lawful and not for what's good. And he said if we can't nail down such delicate matters as marriage and murder, everything will be such a hard case that everything else will go soft. And this is kind of an example. We're giving extremes here, but if you got into things that 10 years ago would have been, and this is to your argument about it being a little bit weak, 10 years ago if you had said, hey, is it wrong to be married to a dog? People are like, that's just stupid. Yeah, of course it's wrong. And then now, I think you'd maybe get a little bit of a, wow.
Not in California.
Well, it's there's an interesting phenomenon that's being tracked by sociologists and psychologists, which is the number of people now who identify as gender nonspecific or I can't seem to find out because maybe I'm willing to do the research, but whatever the Q in LGBTQ stands for, which I understand may be questioning, which is like, I don't choose to identify as any of these. That number has increased significantly within the culture over the course of the last decade. And the question is why? Is it the case that there's some sort of, if it's supposed to be genetically based, is there some explosion of that gene that has now made its way? And the sociologist says this is no, generally speaking. The sociologist usually have a different conclusion. But the psychologists say this is about identifying with groups more than it is actual identity of the person. That is to say, it's maybe the people who are willing to talk about it more derisively will say it's fashionable to claim this now, rather than people actually feel that this is something core about their person. So one does have to, when one controls for societal impact and effects, you have to consider those kind of sociological factors as well. There's an interesting, I gathered this from a very ironclad source over the course of the last week. This is the lady that cuts my hair told me this. She's Korean and has spent a long time in Thailand and lived in Bangkok. And, I think of, in Thailand, I automatically kind of think some sort of sexual deviancy is ingrained in the culture in some way. Now, that's probably an artifact of how American sees parts of Thailand or whatever. But in Thailand, it's forbidden, basically, for guys and girls to hold hands in school or something like that at a certain age and so on. But for a boy who everybody in the culture says this boy is gay, they're allowed to hold hands with girls in school. So they identify the gender of the guy in Thailand as female, basically at a young age, and that's a cultural thing that is not the norm, at least today, now. So at any rate, these kinds of things have to be controlled for, too, if you're going to do this very rigorously. As you can tell, it's not a terribly rigorous study. This is a survey of people without a ton of controls on it. This was another control question. Pick the last answer.
I was going to tell Kevin, I've seen some wives and
I'm sorry, I covered the other stuff that I was covering in the meantime. We should hit that one first.
I saw that look on you. Can we define pencil whipping as just taking random answers?
Yes. Random answers to get your 10 cents. Yes. This one I got the most exercised over, and Tracy again told me that I was a knucklehead. Is it reasonable to think that something would happen if the odds against that thing happening were a billion, 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 billion to one? Now, that's something like 10 to the 700th against. And a lot of people, in fact, the majority of people who didn't answer, I don't know, a slight minority said that, yeah, that's entirely reasonable. to think that something like that could happen.
Play the lottery.
Well, that would I should have re-asked. She said your problem is that nobody understands large numbers and nobody understands probability. Tracy, who teaches this stuff at the PhD level, undergraduate to PhD level, said, "Hey, with college students, with people who want to undergrads don't understand this. When they get into graduate school, we give them classes in this, and they still don't understand it." So maybe this was a terrible question, but I was trying to get to something that was within the teleological argument. What I should have said was, "Do you routinely buy lottery tickets?" And if the answer is no, why not? And they'll say, "Well, the odds are 1,000,000 to 1 against me winning." I'll say, "Okay, what about if you had to win the lottery 1,000 times in a row?" Or let's make it easier. What if you had to win the lottery 10 times in a row to collect any money and the lottery ticket still costs the same? Would you still be buying lottery tickets? And if they say yes, then you say, okay, what about if it was 100 times that? And by the time you get to their standard, I would then point out that a billion, 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 billion times that, you haven't even begun to make a 1% dent in how big that number is. And you still think that's reasonable that it would happen? So I don't know what to do with this question, other than I guess I could throw out the teleological argument if you want, but if Tracy's right, this has to do with the misunderstanding of probability more than anything. So this wasn't a technically controlled question, but this was for me to balance the other hypothesis, which is we believe what we want to believe or have already decided to believe, and that our beliefs then drive a lot of what we think about reality. Do you think God exists? So again, a high majority of people here do, but I look at the bottom two and say, 170 or so of the respondents, of the 700 and change respondents, do not think God exists. Either probably not or definitely not, certainly not. Now, when you go back and you look at some of these arguments, like let's say that you didn't think that was a misunderstanding, things can pop into existence. You might say, well, that's not really driving the equation. But look at our first question. So everything that exists has some sort of cause. And you'll see that...
Or explanation
for its existence. Yep. So this is a premise that people who are on the bottom of this answer down here would probably disagree with if they knew it was part of an argument. But when they haven't yet considered that it might be part of an argument... I guess I'm not going to get to do it that way. The way they answer the question is this. And if they also answer this way, by 1 and 2, they really ought to accept the cosmological argument. Why? Because they've just accepted both premises of the cosmological argument. Disproportionately high to their own stated belief in God. All right, so if I was going to make any point, that's the point, is that people who say they don't believe in God appear to still affirm that anything that exists has some sort of cause or explanation for its existence and that the universe began to exist. Now, not people who are present necessarily, but at least the respondents to the survey, a lot of them ought to accept the cosmological argument. Now, when you turn around and you put it in the terms of the premises and then you lay out the conclusion, they'll say, well, I don't accept that. And then my retort would be, well, you did accept it up until you knew where its conclusion was going to lead you. And that's my point. Now, I'll tell you who's not the only people guilty of that: atheists and agnostics and skeptics and seekers. Let me tell you exactly who else is guilty of that. Us in this room, we do it all the time. So if I can encourage all of us to, and not only in the belief that God exists, which obviously I think is justified and highly justified, or I wouldn't be teaching this class or facilitating this class. But I think that we often adopt a lot of our theology without being where we believe it first and then we seek to support it rather than the other way around. Let's go explore theology. Why? Because it's really, really hard to do it the quote-unquote right way, which is, okay, I'm a new Christian. What should I do? People are like, come to this class. Come to Reston Bible Church. Sit in Solid Ground. Sit in Starting Point. We'll tell you what to believe. What ought to be the response to that? What ought to be the response to that? I'll tell a quick story.
The question, what should you do?
Yeah.
Read the Bible.
Yeah, I did it this way. I was interested in going and being a professional physicist at one point, or studying it to the PhD level. And this may sound like a cop-out, so I'll put it out there in an asterisk. You don't have to believe my motivations on this one. I think the story is interesting in any case. But I loved the idea of relativity. I had explored it as a junior higher and a high schooler at a very basic level and tried to understand it. And when I got to college, I had started to do a little bit of math associated with it. And some of the math that I was doing didn't seem to match with what I was being told by experts in relativity. And so the question was, do I have this wrong? Or does relativity have this wrong? Does Einstein have this wrong? And it probably wasn't Einstein, right? So I went to the Air Force Academy's acknowledged, if not expert, at least most knowledgeable physicist on relativity, and said, outlined this stuff and put this math up for him, and I said, what's wrong with this? And his first answer was, I can't believe that you got through this university understanding so little about vector addition. And I said, I think you misunderstand my question, and I outlined it again for him in a slightly different way. And he stopped and said, I've never thought of that. Now, that doesn't mean that what I thought was right. What it was frustrating for me was this. When you go to a PhD program, what you're not doing is saying, I want greater knowledge than the undergraduates have, necessarily. What you're saying is, that guy right there is an expert in this field. I want to know what he knows. Or that lady right there is an acknowledged expert in this area. I want to know what she does. Because as studying at the PhD level, that's basically what happens. If high school is this broad, college may be more broad at the undergraduate level in certain areas, but you rapidly start to, you abandon all of your core classes, basically, and you ramp right up to psychology or physics or history or whatever it is, and you stop studying all these other things and you just study history. And then you're not studying history, you're studying, Napoleonic thought from, during this decade. And it's extremely narrow, but supposed to be very deep. Well, when you dig that deep, very few people have dug that deeply. And so you're basically following their diggings already. What I think that I learned from that time was, I'm uninterested in submitting myself to 6 years of study, or whatever it's going to be, in pursuit of knowledge if they can't answer my fundamental questions now. So I didn't continue in a formal education, and I still think that was the right answer, because I am the outside the norm thinker that wants to say, why do you think that's the case? Why do you think that's true? Subsequently to that, sometime we can talk about it for those that are interested in those kinds of things. But the reason I bring that up is, if you are going to be a brand new Christian or a brand new anything, the first question you ought to ask is, who's offering to help me learn, and what? Why do they believe what they believe? So I actually think, in starting point, it ought to be 80 questions from the students to the facilitator or teacher saying, how did you learn what you learned? What was your methodology? But of course, nobody does this, right? That would be extremely annoying on all parts. So we tend to put ourselves in the hands of other people to teach us things. As children, that happens to us involuntarily. In college, we tend to pick college not for the reason of, do I believe that the professors here are particularly well-oriented when it comes to their own central beliefs, and that they're extremely honest people. We often are like, I like the way that campus looks, or it's relatively close to home, or it has a great reputation, or whatever. We don't often look into in whose hands am I placing my mind? That is extraordinarily important. And I am, I am loath to hand my mind to anybody that I don't already have good reason to believe is an honest broker who's done the best they can to answer some of these basic questions. So on the theology side, this is why I've said in the past, when someone goes to Reformed Theological Seminary or Dallas Theological Seminary or Princeton Theological Seminary or Oxford, you are already making a choice about what theology you're going to believe, because those are all part of some program somewhere. It's either a Catholic foundation or a Reformed foundation or a Protestant non-Reformed or whatever else it is. You're going to get taught something. Now, the really, really good professors will do their best to say, here are the five different views out there. Pick whichever one you want. But somebody invariably in the class says, Professor, what do you believe and why? And generally speaking, their arguments will be more compelling than the others, probably, because those are the ones that they believe and they understand them to be that way more than the others do. So why am I dragging through all this? It's all to say that the purpose of today, if nothing else, is to say, imagine a mind that's really and completely and truly open. And the best way for a mind to be open is for it not to forecast where it's going, but instead to evaluate the stuff that sits right in front of it against really good, stringent truth standards. Okay. And my point that I've made on like the cosmological argument here is if people were doing that, the same people were doing that took this survey, they ought to come to the conclusion that so far, okay, I accept the cosmological argument for God, these people should also accept the moral argument for God. Okay? Now, we can continue to flip through them, but I'll basically outline it this way. People, yes, sir?
Well, and I was thinking, too, you talk about that unexamined life, and I think that's the issue. Yeah, if you're on Amazon at 2:30 in the morning, and you're looking for an extra 10 cents.
Right. Are those the people whose word you want to take on anything?
Right. Yeah, you're not putting this in the same camp of people who are like, wow, I just accepted two of these questions and I thought through it and that means that God exists.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's sort of like A, B, A, which is good. That's what you want.
That's what I want.
Right. And actually, most people are living like that, right? I mean, if you look at the people around you, you're like, wow, I got to eat out last night. I really enjoyed that. And now I'm going to go to bed and, you know, I'm fat and happy and you know, my job is good and I love TV, and so there, I mean, people just aren't thinking through these things. You know?
Yeah, I'll take a brief right turn on this one and retell something that got told, I think, some point in here, but in a leadership course I took at DOD for civilian types, it basically, they brought in all of these senior executive service you know, civilian leaders and several generals, you know, 4-star generals who are kind of legends and all that stuff. And these guys and gals were speaking on basically what it was to be a senior executive leader in the Department of Defense. And they actually had some other organizations and agencies in there too. And what it kind of took to get in that position. And what was interesting for me in there, and a young lady actually had the temerity to ask the question of some of these seniors, and I watched them get absolutely stumped by her. But they all said two things in response to, you know, what does it take? They would sit there and told a story about, you know, working basically harder than everybody else, longer than everybody else. I was the first person in. I was the last person out. Was in frequently on the weekends. Had to miss ball games and, you know, recitals and birthdays and Christmases and this stuff and deployments and being elsewhere and being at the office, and, you know, it's hard and it's a tough drag, but it's worth it. And somebody was asking, do you have any regrets? And that was this lady. And the regrets, nobody said, I regret not spending more time at the office. All of them said, if I regret anything, it was, you know, I got divorced twice in the course of this job, or, you know, I wish I hadn't missed as much of my kids, X, Y, or Z. So it's to the examine life point. You know, I don't know what their intent was in this senior leadership seminar thing, but I can tell you what I thought, what my conclusion was I don't want to be one of those. Because if what it takes to be one of those is to do things that I know I don't value as highly as the things that they regret, why would I be a fool to do those things? So I must be happier being a more junior person who gets to see his family more than being a very senior person who gets to see his family less. Now, I'm just using a simple criterion there. You know, there's more to it than this. But ultimately, I don't. I think that when people say you should live your life like you, so you'll have no regrets, what people frequently mean by that is live your life like nothing matters but what you want and what you want now. The problem is, unless we're very good at examining them, we're always wrong about what we want now being what we want in the long run. So I think it is the case you should live your life in a way that you have no regrets. But the best way to do that isn't say, what do I want now, and pursue it. What you ought to say is, when I'm 80 years old, looking back on my life, when I'm dead and looking back on my life from the other side of the grave, what will I have wished I had done? And then do those things, because that's what you want. It's not what you think that you want today. And the way that I've done that is I'll go find a bunch of old people. And I said, tell me what you wish you had done differently. And then I find, and not just any old person, take as many as you can, but also ask and put particular value on the ones who seem very, very happy, right? So if they made it the whole way there and they're very, very happy, they have kind of done a good job, at least as long as the living are known, at becoming happy. So, and how did they do that? And I'll tell you what the findings on that one are, very simple. And I'd point you back to that Harvard study that we've cited a few times. I forget the name of the study now. I'll look it back up and I'll publish it again here for you on the Facebook page. But it's the longitudinal 75-year long-running study, dual cohort. They initially started with a bunch of rich white kids that went to Harvard. Someone told them, you should probably control and get some other people into this. They got a second cohort that wasn't just all rich white guys. And Kennedy was one of the people that was in the initial study. Obviously didn't make it all the way to the end of the study for reasons everybody knows historically. But they did the summary of the study in the 90s, and whenever it completed in the 90s, as I remember. And the study director said this, if I was going to summarize the whole report, happiness equals love, in five words, happiness equals love, full stop. So this is Harvard saying, here's a long-running study on what makes people happy, and it's love in their life. And they had some particular interesting findings, but ultimately that's what it boils down to. So one of the reasons that I'm very pro-Christianity, that's separate from my own experiences in Christianity, is just as a philosophy, it's one of the few that makes, as central as it does, the notion of love, in that it says God is love, that it says that the two commandments that matter most are about love, all that kind of stuff. So it's at least ought to give you a hint that of the things that are a possibility of being true, that one seems to be true, at least experientially, or at least not true, at least something that you should pursue, thinking about. Okay, so maybe that was too long a diversion, but let me get back to this. Yes, sir?
He says you'd like to talk to older people about
what makes you happy. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll be 80 next year, so I'd probably qualify. I'd be glad to sit down with you.
Let's do that. Let's absolutely do that.
He's going to want his dime, though.
I believe you.
The respondents that answered, when they got to your last question, did they have the option of going back and changing their answers?
That's a very good question.
Yeah, that's a great question. Technically, yes, that can be done. Yes, that can be done. There's probably a way to set it up, but that's not the case. And for the next one, we'll give that a shot. I don't know how to do that.
Why don't you let me make up the next question?
Okay, let's do it in council. It'll be a good one. All right. Why have I picked these topics? I don't. This is a simplistic way that I view knowledge. We've got physics. We have maths. We have kind of intuition. Intuition to me is, you may have intuitions about all the things on the top side, but I think a lot of people make choices based on kind of what their intuition is about what's true at the time, and they don't have a rigid mathematical system or logical system or whatever else that they tend to follow. So I put that one in there. Logic, and I mean that both very narrowly and then also kind of broadly. Morality and theology. All of these things often get put on par with philosophy, but if you take philosophy to mean what it was originally meant to mean, and the way that philosophers at least think that they talk about it, all of those things fit into one's philosophy. So even to go back to Shakespeare, the whole, there are more things, Horatio, and heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy. He's using philosophy there the right way. So at least I'll say it in the Shakespearean sense of philosophy. That means the way you see the world in total. And all of these other things in here are merely tools that you use or areas of the world in, that you are examining. I probably should have put... this one in here as well. What argument have I left out? Transcendental, that would probably fit in this one. And this one over here too. Different people like to regard the world in different ways, I think. So some people, if I put up a graph and talk about the shape of the curve and what the derivative is at a certain point, they very much like that because they're like, ah, now I get it and understand it. Other people are like, could you please return to English? And the other side, if you start talking to things that are, people are highly intuitive, or I didn't put in here where a whole bunch of things that maybe fit within this zone here of people who think linguistically that sits next to logically, but people who think who process things in very verbal ways. They're not pictorial. Or people who process things in ways relevant to experiences that they have, relevant to their sets of experience, and they very much build their world outwards in an agglomeration, and they don't like to try to cut it into pieces with these other constructs. All of these are different, and I don't know that one can ought to say one way of knowing things is better than the other. I think all of these things need to be taken in balance. Yes, sir.
And then, did you say then linguistics sit right next to logic for you? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I haven't organized the top set of lines that thoughtfully. I do think that linguistics is more closely related to logics than they are to, and you know, math and logic ought to be next to each other too. So I stuck intuition in there. I think for reasons of space, because I erased mathematics and put math to get another one.
Linguistics a little bit more towards intuition.
I think you could say that. Yeah. But how these are interrelated is you're being more thoughtful than I was. is not the point that I have put any significant thought into, but more that there are a lot of different ways to see it. And for people who say, look, I'm very much physics and math. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead, Dennis.
Oh, which one of these categories would include people who just go along with the crowd, whatever they hear, they just, you know, they're raised a certain way and they just, okay.
That's an interesting.
The people who say, well, they say that.
They say, yeah, yeah.
They say crowd.
Well, I the funny thing is, if my relativity story, physics professor story, it has anything has any grain of truth in it, it's this. All of those people, all these categories include that. There are a whole bunch of people who say, well, physics tells us X. Physics tells us X, or a physicist told you that, or a popularizer of physics told you that. So all these categories include people who told you stuff, like morality and theology. That this one cuts into the church a little bit. Hey, you got told that this is what God wants you to do, and that this is the right moral thing to do. By whom? Well, by my pastor. Is my pastor qualified to tell me that? And if so, by what type of qualification? So I think, Dennis, to answer your question, all these are open to that happening. And I think, in fact, let me take one more second to comment on it. This is a very profound part of what I'm hope to point out. Not that I'm trying to think profoundly, whether I am or not, up to you. But this points to a profound consideration, which is, why do we accept the things in all the categories that we do? And what I'm asking you to do is to tear them down to first principles and work your way up from there, if you really are interested in knowing the truth. And if that's not something that you feel yourself capable of, what I'll say is, don't let anybody tell you that's the case, ever. Because thinking simply and basically can be done by everybody. And anytime thought gets so fancy that you don't think you can understand it, it's probably got something hidden in it that isn't true. Another way to say that is, I think the best truths are the simplest truths. And in fact, I'll appeal to Richard Feynman on this one, the famous physicist, who said, basically, if you can't teach it something simply, then you don't understand it. And I very much like the way that, you know, you've seen his six easy pieces and six hard pieces, that kind of stuff. The way he explains things, and it's not the simplest way, but he has some different audiences, but he has a good job at teaching things very simply. I think great truths are going to be simple.
He also said anybody who says they understand quantum mechanics
is lying. Yeah, right. he says that a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but there's some real truth to that, too. And at any rate. Okay, now why do I draw this drawing? It's simple. There is a simple truth here. When you combine results of this kind of study, or if you think about these things on your own as not a part of, I'm in a class talking about arguments of the existence of God. If you just took them as simple statements and you tried to evaluate their value, you're basically going to walk away with having agreed with the argument, many of these arguments for God. Now, my point of this drawing right here is some of these arguments will be more convincing to other people. If you are not a person who first and foremost thinks rigorously this way, there's no way this argument is going to be convincing to you, because your brain works on these side, on this side, or it's principally thinking about these things. Now, it's not that it doesn't use logic, but it's not super rigorous into the logical side. By the same way, if you don't, I mean, these kinds of things, if that, if Tracy's right about this response here about billion, where was it? Well, wherever it was, you know, the one where everybody was pretty evenly split across it. Maybe if she's right, and that the reason for that is that people don't understand. Keep going.
No, there.
That was it? Nope. That was the determinist question. Yeah, there you go. Nope. Second to last one. Thank you. I wrote the thing, and I don't even know where it is. Okay. Maybe the reason, if she's right about this, that's because this doesn't make sense. This number up here doesn't even begin to make sense to people. So if that's the case, well, this one might not be compelling to you. This one, actually, maybe I should have said, I think this one stretches at least across to here. The cosmological argument is a good argument in, you know, between the cosmological and the moral, I think those are probably the two easiest to understand for everyone. And I think that based on the responses we got, they ought to also be the most compelling. Now, let's pretend for a second that there were these five arguments and no more for the existence of God. These are arguments for God's existence. So we haven't considered arguments against God's existence, but arguments for God's existence. If people already agree with the premises, if a majority of people already agree with a majority of the premises, that should be informative to us in some way. I'm not saying that means it's true, but I'm saying that ought to mean something at a minimum. Maybe even where the burden lies on who needs to prove what to some degree. But let's say that you look you don't even look at the arguments, but you just look at your premises and you say, basically, I agree with the cosmological premises of the cosmological argument, and I agree with the premises of the moral argument. Well, what is the result of both of those sets of premises? Well, it's the conclusion that God exists. So based on what people on Mechanical Turk, who responded to this anyway, based on the data that they gave us and nothing else, they ought to accept these two arguments. Period. They ought to accept those two arguments. Now, of course, we think certain things like, well, it looks like the Earth is flat and the sun goes, you know, in this arc over the top of us, and maybe it starts and, you know, gets in a cart and goes back to the side and goes again. Maybe that seems to be the case. And so on further reflection, when you learn other stuff, you realize, oh, it is a little more complex in some sense than that, and simpler in other senses too. In terms of the number of laws that it takes to get that done, the system we believe in right now is one of the simplest out there. It's gravity, and, you know, F equals, every action has an equal and opposite reaction. Those are basically enough to give you the whole model of the way the Earth goes around the sun right now, and the sun goes around the galaxy and all that kind of stuff. So that's not terribly complex. It's pretty simple. But my point to you is, I've stated many times, but basically, the majority of people ought to be defaulting to accepting arguments for the existence of God. Frequently, when I talk to not people presently in the room, but other people who are skeptics or agnostics, you'll often hear the refrain, well, there is no evidence. There's just no evidence for God. Now, I would turn around and say, well, what do you think about the following statements? Now, unfortunately, you're already in a discussion about God. But if you say, you know, what do you think about the following statements? Or you just lay out two or three of these arguments. I still hear the same people say, but yeah, there's just no compelling evidence for God. There's no evidence for God. I'm like, I just gave you three. I can give you more. Why is this not evidence? And what they mean to say is it's not compelling. Well, why is it not compelling? Well, my point of going through all this is to say that probably has more to do. And by the way, let's flip it and go to the other side, on the Christian side. What if you said, hey, here's some major problems with the scriptures in general. Do you think the Bible is absolutely without error? Here's my top 10 lists of errors in the Bible. What do you think about that? Most people, Christians, won't turn around and be like, yeah, I agree those are errors. Hang on a second, let me go back, readjust everything the way that I am at least looking at Scripture and I understand it, and let me come back to you at some point and with a thoughtful, measured integration of these points that you've given me right here. And of the 10, eight of them, I think under further reflection, you said they're mistakes, they're not mistakes. These two seem to be real mistakes. What does that imply? People don't do that. And I'm not saying that's the case. I'm just saying that's not how we do it either on our side. We turn around and typically say, oh, that person is just a, you know, fill in the blank, an atheist, or they're just trying to, or they don't know, or I can trust God, not man, whatever it is, but we don't look at it. I would suggest to you, don't be afraid to look into it, because I did. And if I hope by now you have the sense that I'm not a guy who's going to shy away from the truth, hopefully, no matter what it is or where I find it. If it turns out evolution is the way that everything was done, that's fine. That doesn't bother me in the least. It turns out Big Bang Theory, where God, a deistic version of it, basically, when it comes to the laws of physics, boom, exists. It happens all out there. That's not a problem for me at all, because the cosmological and because these other arguments already tell me, at least based on what I understand, that God's behind it. And if God just happens to play billiards particularly well with every atom in the universe, why does that bother me? Unless people are going to say, well, the Genesis account is clearly literal and it has to mean this thing literally, and then therefore this can't be true. Okay, then that's something that needs to be talked about. But you see my point. I'm hopefully willing to go any distance, and I think that all that is possible, that we ought to think that all those things are possible until we figure out what is most probable and most likely true. But just looking at the arguments that are sitting out there, how is it that we don't conclude that God exists is really the amazing thing to me. Yes, sir. Dennis, go ahead, sir.
I don't agree with about 80% of what you said about these arguments, but that's beside the point. Let's assume that you're right, that all of this proves that God exists.
Yep.
Why does it have to be your God?
Right. Great question. That one we will get to in some of the other classes, but let's say that let's give kind of a short answer and say, let's just say you like the cosmological argument, you think it's a good one, and let's say that you like the moral argument. So what does that give you? Well, if the universe, which is time, space, matter, and energy, as far as we know, had a beginning, then whatever started it was timeless, spaceless, immaterial. If you think of the energy content of the universe, the energy delta at least, enormously powerful.
So Zeus, right?
Well, hold on. Timeless, spaceless, and immaterial. That's not Zeus. Enormously powerful and personal. Why personal? Because an impersonal force can't make a decision to change something from the state that it is into the state that we see right now. So a beginning implies that one. Impersonal and moral, if there's a moral one, implies that there we can add to this good or all good. And if you like the ontological one, it's a greatest conceivable being, omni everything. So by the time that you put the pieces together and you say what God do we have that fits these criteria, this basically screens out every God in all of mankind except for the God of Christianity. I didn't do that right. Judaism and Islam. This is what you're left with. So this is why I like these arguments, is it takes it down to those three. Now you got to fight it out amongst those three to figure out which one it is.
Well, there's a lot of guys you don't even know about. That could be. There's been a lot of guys, I think, invented by human beings that are going by the wayside now. Those people don't believe in it.
Sure, but if the point is this, if what you're saying is my scientific endeavors, my logical endeavors, my moral and theological endeavors, or let's just say my moral endeavors here, and my intuition lead me to believe that the God that's out there must look like this. So that's where your starting point. Your starting point isn't Christianity is true or false. Your starting point is this.
Right.
Then you have to say, well, which of them fit into that one? And so now these are all that's left of your list of candidates of which we currently know that could be true. Okay, so maybe it's the case that there's maybe it's the case that there's an unknown.
And we discussed this actually because
question.
We talked about this. Susan Rice, who's that famous writer, I don't know if she writes novels, I don't read them, but she came to the conclusion, looked into Judaism simply because so many other religions and so many other gods have fallen by the wayside. I mean, nobody right now is offering their child to Moloch.
Right.
That doesn't happen.
Why is that? Why is it so compelling that God, that the God of Judaism is ancient? And then, you know, getting into Judaism, she became a Christian reading the New Testament.
But why are they offering their children to the God of Scientology, which they are?
They are.
I think they're in.
How quickly will that fall?
Hopefully nobody's actually sacrificing their children. That was the way they did it back in the day, but maybe they're raising them that way, right? Well, whether there are thetans around or not, the bottom line is, if you did this right here, this actually gets rid of the God of Scientology, doesn't it?
This what?
This would get rid of the God of Scientology. So if you had done this work first, you would not have concluded that the God of Scientology would be the real one.
I apologize again. I'm from Berean.
Please.
As we indicated last week, we've been studying poetry for the last few months. So,
I forgot to add poetry up here.
In the Psalms, you know, we've been doing things on righteousness. So the question I ask is, if we're to be righteous, is we're asked to walk by faith. But what I'm sensing here is you're asking me to walk by knowledge. And how do I reconcile those?
Very good. And then I also want to call Skylar. I want to call on Skylar too, because if he's not bursting at the seams, he should be. And we're down. Faith is a regard. A regard. Faith is basically equal to trust. There is no difference between faith and trust. Why? Because you even if you're going to say it's not a person. Well, you've heard the old chair argument. I put faith in the chair I put trust in the chair that it will bear me up. Those are identical. Okay. If faith equals trust, saying I have faith is an incomplete statement. And in fact, when people say I'm a person of faith, that drives me insane. Mm-hmm. Because, exactly. people, you have to have faith in something in particular. Specify what you have faith in. Label your axes. Specify what you have faith in. What's the faith in? So you can't just have faith in God, okay? Because I have faith in God is like saying I have faith in the universe. Okay, the universe exists, so what? What do you mean you have faith in it? It doesn't mean anything. The thing, Abraham did not get credit for being righteous for having faith in God, did he?
It was credited to him as righteousness.
For what? Well, what did he believe? That God exists? Let me quote another part of the Bible. So what? The demons believe that and shudder. So I believe God exists, true of Satan. Okay, so good job. You're in the pool with Satan now. Let's say you want to get out of the pool with Satan. What's the difference? God promised certain things. What did he promise to Abraham? What did he promise to Abraham?
Descendants.
Two things, yep. Descendants and land. Basically, that's what he said. I'll make a great nation of you, and I'll give you all that your eyes see right here. Okay, that Abraham believed God, he acted like it was true, and it was credited to him, as you say, as righteousness. It's believing in the promises that God has made to you or to humanity, period. When we go and say things like, well, I have faith that God's going to make me successful at work. Did he promise to make you successful at work? Then you ought not have faith in that because God didn't promise that. So I could go on and on, but you see the point, sir. Hopefully it answered your question. Skylar. Comments. Not on that one, on this stuff. I'm interested in your take on this.
So I think Dennis hit on it. Your tiny, tiny question mark at the bottom.
Yep.
I think is important. If you look at this and go, take a step back and you say, what can we believe from the arguments and what we state that this being exist that, you know, initiated the universe, and what do we know about how we should behave and act? You cull the herd of the historic faiths and beliefs, and then you get down to, you know, the monotheistic beliefs, and then even within those, I think we fall into a trap of arguing over the minor nuances, and that sounds very dismissive, but the minor nuances of each faith.
Yeah.
And really, what you should do is go, okay, I can't be certain, but what are the core tenets of these faiths, and what should we take away from those?
So a brief pause here until you continue. I want to say I agree 100% with this. In fact, two quick comments, and then back to Skylar. It should be said that Dennis is right and Skylar is right, okay? It's these three and the question mark in there. Now, these arguments up here are not intended to show the God of Christianity. You have to ask, what's the intent and purpose of an argument? And Skylar knows this. I'm not saying Skylar isn't saying this. But for those that are wondering, this only gives you a broad theistic or deistic God. But it's one step at a time, right? One step at a time. So once you've got this one, now it matters which version of that one is it. And the great thing about these arguments, I think one of the great things about these arguments is it cuts out more of these historical belief systems than any other way of doing business. That's why I like the arguments for existence of God, not for the purpose of arguing anything to the atheist or the skeptic or the agnostic, but principally for the purpose of helping us call down what is it that I ought to believe in if I'm trying to be as broad and cast my mental net as broad as possible. We will get to this. We're not done yet. We're going to get to this. There are arguments specific to why this system is the right system, and specifically why this system might be the right system. So we'll make that argument. We'll make those arguments later. But he is absolutely right in the case that this is now the set that we're looking at, where that question mark, technically it could go on and on and on, but this is a relatively narrowly defined God. Now, to the second point that he made, it is very important to know what's the similarities in these three. What are the similarities in these three? Because if there are core things that are the same in all of them, that's not, there should be an explanation for that, but it also might be indicative of some of the natural truth that might be lying out there. In the view of natural theology, that's not data that you should just throw out. Okay.
But
sorry.
I think when you go down that path and you kind of get to, okay, here we're coming from the macro level down, and then you alluded to it earlier about the atheist cases against Christianity, where
yes.
They come in with very narrow, okay, biblical inerrancy. We shouldn't hinge our faith on biblical inerrancy because it makes Christianity unnecessarily fragile. And if you have, when you do that, you've done it from the macro level, you've kind of worked in and said, God is somewhere in these broad tenets. And then you jump all the way to the end of the spectrum and say, the Bible is inherently true, and an atheist comes in, anyone who is questioning the Bible, I shouldn't say an atheist, comes in and goes, no, there's an error here. If that destroys, if you set up your belief to be destroyed by a single defeater, then you have not truly thought through
yep.
your belief system.
So
and I think
all,
that's what we need to, I think that's the approach that we need to have, is to look for the most, focus on the macro tenets of our belief and the core message, and not get hung up on the importance of immersion baptism or some minute part of our belief.
So this should sound, what Skylar is outlining, I also agree with in the strongest possible terms, not the least of which is, that's this is a post hoc, but that's what Christ says to do. Remember, build your foundation on the rock, not on sand. Because when, another way of saying that is, if you, I like to think of when you build your house, whatever your house of knowledge is, and we think that they're very large and a certain way, if this portion of it is cracked or rotten, and it's not true, then your house will fall down, and you're back to zero again. Or you ignore it, and you paste it up, and it's going to collapse someday when the trial gets hard enough. Something you have to, I see you didn't stand by 1 second.
Basic belief, right?
This is back to properly basic beliefs. Is don't go lay it out more. So maybe a simple way to say it is this. I agree with what Skylar says, and I find it personally, my faith was shaken in college when I had gone in with a system of beliefs that was relatively simple, and I built the rest of this huge structure on it, and somebody pointed out something that I couldn't answer. So the reason I am where I am today is because I tore it all down and I started again. Now, what does that mean for me? You will find me one of the most confident believers out there. I am as certain as I am that I am sitting here breathing today that Christianity is true in its core tenets. And furthermore, I've had experiential verification of that one that in my mind is completely undeniable, completely undeniable. And so my point to you is this: opening your mind and being willing to think about these things doesn't mean that you should lose your faith. As a person who did that to at least some degree, it did nothing but strengthen my faith, because now my faith survives every attack that's levied against it because it's grounded in good core true things. It's not grounded in things that I believed for convenience's sake or ad hoc. Dennis, and then back to Skylar if he's got any last comments. We're out of time.
Okay, what I meant by, if you can go back up a little bit.
Yes, sir.
That question mark down there, I wasn't saying things like, well, Scientology is equal to the rest of them. What I'm saying is, if all of this is true and this and some God exists, he may, or she may be, very, very well may be someone who's just looking at all the stuff that we've done and saying, how did they come up, no offense, how did they come up with this business that I had a son and killed him and then raised him from the dead?
Yes.
I mean, it could be something entirely different and still satisfy all of those.
Absolutely the case.
Okay.
Stipulated. That's exactly right. So you got to do more work to get to one or to anything other than this set total. If you want to parse this set, you have to do more work, and we'll do that work. Okay. I'm out of time, but we'll continue some of this discussion next time as well, and then we'll launch into our next topic. But I hope that thinking about these things, as you spend time thinking about these things, I hope that what you will see is you actually have really, really good reasons. It's not simply, let me be very clear. Bereans does not say this. So what I'm about to say is not a critique leveled against Bereans, because I know where you're coming from, sir. I think we're coming from the same spot. This is, although the person who asked it was saying I'm from Bereans and this is what we've been talking about, let me point back to Christianity writ large in America, in Protestant modern Christian culture. It is a badge of merit to close one's eyes and ears to evidence and say, I believe it because God said it. Well, newsflash, if God didn't say it directly to you, you're already getting it from somewhere. And you ought to know that really, really well. Really well. What your chain of evidence is. Because you're betting your life on it. You're betting your eternal life on it. So know it well. So do not let, and nobody who sits in this class ever does, I mean, I'm preaching to the choir here, but don't let other people, don't let your Christian brothers and sisters sit there and say, I'm just going to believe it because I want it to be true. Their faith is fragile and it needs to be shored up, and you are some of the people who can do that.
That's why I said it depends on properly basic belief, because I think most of modern Protestant Christianity, serious believers in Jesus Christ and followers of Jesus Christ, have much of their faith and experience based on interaction with the Holy Spirit, in which case I would say very valid belief system, maybe not as provable to outside sources,
right?
No less genuine. And no, so yes, in one way, I mean, this almost sounds Gnostic, like, oh well, you know, we have this special knowledge, so we're a different tier. And I know you don't mean that.
I don't. And let me double down on that before I. So this is a brilliant point. Paul's experience with Jesus was not in any of these veins. You know, he wasn't considering these arguments because he met the guy, right? Or he met God. It's not the guy. It's the same with Moses, right? You're not like, Moses, tell me your top five arguments for God. And he's like, you talking about the burning column behind me? The dead guys here because they approached the mountain? We can experientially verify this. And this is back to our, I recommend again listening to the class on properly basic beliefs, because those are important. But it's also important, we all have a desire for that to be the case, to point behind us at the column of fire and cloud and say, no, I know this personally. But the truth is, most people today in America have not had that kind of belief. And so I think because they haven't, rather than seeking it, they instead try to reinterpret stuff that's happened in the past in that vein. I would encourage you not to do that. A genuine experience of God is absolutely unquestionable. Absolutely unquestionable. Like, when you think of the other possible, when people raise stuff, you're like, yeah, I know how it looks like that from the outside. But trust me, it's just not that. And I'm not talking about an overconfidence you've talked yourself into. I'm talking about, like, you know it as plainly as you know that you're conscious. That's what real experiences with God are like. And I would also encourage people in here. I mean, here, you hear me. I'm a bit of an empiricist. I like to do things on the math and physics side. My verifications that God exists, this is great as an intellectual thing. It makes me intellectually confident in God. But my confidence in God comes from a handful of experiences that I will lay. I have laid out some of them in the past, but I'm happy to lay it out for anybody that's interested in order to say, this right here is what convinces me more than anything else. And it is meeting the living God and watching things that he does that is compelling. So don't think that that's not possible, and don't even think that it's not something that you won't experience. It is something that you ought to experience. Thank you, Kevin. All right, I'm way over on time. I apologize. Let's talk more about this next time, and thank you very much for your time and interaction.
Thanks, Kevin.
Yes, sir.